Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
I would be remiss not to flag your recent guidance on voluntary carbon markets and just applaud the commission for the leadership in that space.
Comments from Buddy Allen with the American Cotton Shippers Association at a December meeting for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, or CFTC.
Many of the companies that I represent are investing in products to add value to agriculture and stakeholders through regen, sustainability, and all practices of the like. We need definition and certainty in those markets and those products so that they can be authenticated and that value can increase for agricultural stakeholders. You are at the tip of the spear, and I applaud you for that. I hope the broader administration and Congress will continue to focus on this emerging market because it's critically important.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So we do have an extension of the Farm Bill for the next 12 months.
Amy Hagerman is Oklahoma State Extension Ag Policy Specialist.
Kind of at this last negotiation in the budget for the going forward for the rest of this fiscal year, they were able to put in that extension of the existing Farm Bill for 2024. What does that mean? That means programs will look exactly like what they did in 2023. Mm-hmm. So as you're applying for your agricultural risk coverage or price loss coverage, those will look very, very similar. If you're looking to apply for disaster or emergency assistance, those will look very similar. If you're looking to apply for the Conservation Reserve Program, it'll look pretty similar to the last year. It provided some assurance and continuation for the next year as they go through these additional negotiations for the Farm Bill. And there's a lot to consider there. Mm-hmm. This is a very expensive Farm Bill, potentially, as compared to what we've had in the past. Why? Because we all just know everything seems to be more expensive right now, whether you're talking about costs of production and your seed and fertilizer, whether you're talking about machinery, everything just seems to be more expensive right now. The food we see in the grocery store. So there's a lot of conversation happening there, especially in an environment where we're really cost sensitive mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C. right now, and how much things are going to cost and what government spending is going to look like.
The longer we go, the less likely we'll get a new farm bill.
So if you look historically in other farm bills that have been negotiated in the year of a presidential election, the farm bill is by its very nature bipartisan. Mm-hmm. You really have to bring both parties together to successfully put together a farm bill and to negotiate that farm bill. That can be more challenging in a presidential election year or an election year in general. So that may mean that more negotiation is happening, that maybe those negotiations are a little bit harder. And also you've got attention diverted away from the farm bill because of campaigning as well. So if we don't see a farm bill by about March, thereabout, as we get into primary season, the attention may really focus away from it for a bit of a period of time, and it may actually be after the election that we see a farm bill happen.
Doesn't mean we don't still have deadlines.
We kind of held off. Usually we start making decisions in October on a lot of these programs. We really couldn't in October because we didn't know what it would look like for the next year. So it's making all of those decisions and making sure that we make them going into that first month of the new year. So January 30th is actually a really important deadline for a lot of programs. For our livestock forage program, for those producers or in counties that are eligible for that, that application is due January 30th. We had talked about all the disasters that happened in the last year. So for the livestock indemnity program and the emergency assistance for livestock, honeybees, and farm-raised fish, the ELAP program that does the hay hauling and the water hauling and the bee losses, that has also been extended out. That's January 30th now, too. And really in an interesting, very recent piece of information, the USDA has actually relaxed the notice of loss reporting rules on LIP and ELAP. So what that means is that if your application was rejected earlier in 2023 because you didn't notify for the loss within that 30-day window, they might actually reconsider that application. If it was rejected for other reasons, obviously that's different. Or if you just missed the notice of loss window and so you didn't put in an application, well, you know, now that's been relaxed a little bit, just trying to make these things more user-friendly for producers. So a lot of that happens by January 30th, and we're thinking about those year ends, making sure people have their crop reports all in, all taken care of for the next year, making sure that any kind of insurance deadlines, that we're watching those, we're meeting those. Those are different for different crops, so we've got to watch those individually for the crop, individual crops.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We do see that as prices change significantly, margins need to change to accommodate that as well.
Suzanne Sprague is with the CME Group and was speaking recently at a CFTC Ag Advisory meeting.
We have seen for a lot of commodity markets, absolute prices go up in these markets, and that also causes margins to increase. So here are a couple periods for corn stand out. Obviously, the periods around May and July of 2021, so you can see spikes that were occurring on the price side and how we were adjusting margins to account for that increased volatility. There were not any breaches in that period of time, but we did come close to the price levels actually starting to increase above margin coverage. And so you'll see that in that period of time, margins remain high until the volatility starts to come down, which is more around the September of 2021 timeframe. So that's really the pattern that we're tracking in addition to margin levels with respect to absolute price levels. So it's a busy slide, but this is meant to give you a picture of what we look at every day. And it is common for market participants to look at these factors as well. So many of our market participants also track the price changes of these markets every day and the absolute prices of these commodities against margin coverage. And that's a dialogue that we engage in on a regular basis with the market.
That's not just in corn, but in wheat as well.
The period here of interest mainly is in March of 2022. So you can see a breach actually happening where the price move did move above the margin level for a particular day. And so that causes us to evaluate potential margin increases, in which case we did make increases around that time period for this contract. I will note that a breach on its own doesn't necessarily mean margins need to increase. The coverage standard of 99% generally means you should expect two or three breaches in a year based on the number of trading days. So a breach is not unexpected or a bad thing, but it does cause us to evaluate if volatility will persist and if market conditions have changed for that contract such that we need to increase margins to ensure that we continue achieving that coverage level of 99%.
And in rough rice.
So again, the time periods are somewhat different in terms of the volatility spikes that we've seen in that contract. But this is another example, especially in early to mid-2020, where we did see a significant change in profit and loss on a daily basis or daily price changes for the contract that caused us to increase requirements around that time frame. And this is an example of where hindsight is 2020. So you will see that those increased margin levels did persist for a longer period of time due to the implied volatility that we were seeing in the marketplace and the number of significant price changes that we saw day over day. So hindsight's 2020, and that looking at the period of volatility that really starts from, let's say, September of 2020 and then goes through 2021, the levels were coming down slowly, and that's a common theme for us as well. We tend to increase margins quickly to make sure we achieve that coverage standard. Again, we try not to make increases in large amounts day over day. We generally step those in over multiple days to make sure we're not causing liquidity pressures or funding pressures on the marketplace. But when we bring them down, it does tend to happen somewhat more slowly as volatility is persisting and potentially decreasing on a slower level too. So this is just an example of where those margin levels did remain higher than price changes for a period of time due to the amount of volatility that we saw in a short period and the implied volatility of the options market.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
A lot of times, and of course, I was practiced as a veterinarian for several years and then served as the extension veterinarian down here at College Station now.
Dr. Tom Hargrave talks about the role that nutrition plays in health of cattle, especially when it comes to combating parasites.
So through the years, I've seen a lot of people, you know, okay, these cattle aren't doing so well, so they just have to be wormy, right? So that's the next thing is we're going to worm them. My argument is always there's not much nutritional value in a bottle of dewormer. So what are we feeding the animal, right? And then, you know, how much protein's going there? How much energy's going in there? All these other things that would tie back to good nutrition. And the other thing, if you've got an animal with a lot of parasites, especially calves, because like I said, they don't have a very good immunity. And then we've got to remember that that those worms have actually bored a hole or incised into the wall of the stomach, right? Okay, just like our stomach, if you had a lot of little ulcers in your stomach, first of all, you're not going to eat a lot, eat as much as you normally would, because it kind of upsets everything. And then your digestive system is not going to be necessarily real effective. Yeah, it's a little different, of course, in cattle, but they do have a true stomach, and that's what's affected in it. It can sure affect their appetite, and it can affect their gain.
There's also this idea of parasitic immunity.
As they grow older and they're exposed to parasites, and parasites are going to be there, right? I mean, to a degree, so we're not going to eliminate all the parasites, but we can get them to a level that they're controlled. And so as they're exposed, they do develop some immunity. And so when you're looking at cows, usually you're going to see the load is lower. They tend to have more ostertagia, which is the one that causes the issue in them, because a lot of the other parasites, Coprea especially, are more likely to be in calves, because even those calves, that's the first parasite that they start to develop immunity to. So if they're weaned calves, they probably develop some immunity to Coprea. But again, there's already some damage done. So the earlier that you can wean those calves without getting back before that time that, they're picking up parasites, then that's probably the best time to get them. Now, again, I would even on those calves, it would be good to do some fecal. This is called the fecal egg reduction count. In other words, we worm them, we test them, and we see how much we've reduced the eggs. Okay. And as you go on, if you want to get into a program like this, you can work with your veterinarian. Certainly there's some good studies published where we can actually do this a little cheaper. And in other words, we can pull some samples. We can do a lot of other things. And I would leave that for you and your veterinarian to discuss how that would fit into your operation. But, a lot of people, well, it costs a fair bit of money to get these tested. It does cost something, right? There is a little cost to it. But again, if it's not working, if that drug is not working, then you're losing a lot of money. What we'll find a lot of times too is people are using several different drugs and everything. When we actually go in and analyze their cattle, analyze what's happening in there, they probably don't need to use as much dewormer or as often, et cetera. So again, I think it's really a win-win deal. It doesn't say you have to do it every year, but at least I would get a starting point and say, okay, I know where I'm going from here.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I was actually home in South Dakota at the beginning of November and catching the tail end of corn and sunflower harvest.
Summer Mersinger is a commissioner with the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
It struck me, when you're not home for a while and you go back, the cost that goes into production agriculture. When you see the number of, a line of combines trying to get through these fields, I think my dad, He cut down the last row of corn at 3 a.m. Because they've got to get it out of the ground. They've got it, if there's weather coming or whatever. They will work through the night. And, it's the combines, it's the semis moving the grain. There is so much cost involved in production agriculture. And it's just a good reminder that our agriculture markets truly are used for hedging those costs and risks that are involved in production agriculture. So they have to work. The other thing I will say is, people may worry that, we spend more time thinking about, whether it's some of the financial markets or crypto or whatever. But if you need a reminder of what's truly important to this agency, I was recently before the Senate Agriculture Committee, and I would say 90% of the questions I was asked had to do with agriculture. So it is the most important thing that we do here.
CFTC focused on open and fair markets. What about the Treasury? That's Secretary Janet Yellen.
I think there were very significant supply disturbances that were caused by the pandemic, shortages, big shifts in the structure of demand that led to sectors like automobiles that were faced with enormous excess demand, shortages of chips, shipping, huge increase in shipping costs from Asia. So these supply disruptions have gradually come down. And, you know, well, I can't say exactly how much that's contributed to lower inflation. I think that's been a factor. You also had enormous disruption in the labor market with, a very significant number of people laid off or losing their jobs who need to find new work. And I think that led to disruptions in the labor market that are also gradually healing. In a way, the natural rate of unemployment, I believe, is coming down as people settle into new jobs. I mean, that's a very disruptive process. We saw not only desperation on the part of firms as the economy picked up and they were desperately trying to add to their workforce, but mismatch of workers and firms that led people to quit their jobs, look for other works until they settled into a good match. So quits were unusually high, job openings were very high, wage increases were very high as the labor market, had been so disrupted. But now if you look at it, job openings are down substantially. I don't mean by that to levels that are worrisome low, but to normal, good labor market, pre-pandemic levels. The quit rate, which is, I think, a driver of wage increases, and you're seeing quit rates come down, again, toward normal levels. So the labor market's normalizing, and labor force participation has moved up, certainly among adults. We've seen it move up to the highest levels in decades, and that's helping to ease inflationary pressures as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So there's a lot of comparisons to the 80s.
Kurt Covington, Senior Director of Institutional Credit at Ag America.
You know, we had some international turmoil. We had, sizable crop inventories back then. Land values were starting to appreciate. And generally speaking, prior to the farm crisis of the 80s, farm income was okay. So there are some similarities to it. What I would say that's a little bit different today is that one of them is the farmer themselves. Many of them have gotten much better at controlling their costs, understanding their costs, and having systems in their business, accounting systems, and help in understanding the cost structure and those costs that tend to and can get out of control if not managed carefully. But the other side of this as well, which has been very interesting to me, despite these high interest rate, land values continue for the most part to remain elevated. And that's a complete other discussion than what we're talking about here, but it's a fascinating view of land values more recently, as the USDA described in August of this year, that land values continue to increase, but clearly at a decreasing rate.
So what do producers need to keep in mind this year?
You know, one of the backbones of U.S. agriculture has always been the family farm. And I still think there's a lot of misconception of what quote unquote corporate farming is and big farming is. What I will say is this, is that we at Ag America will serve the small family farm as our core. That's not to say we don't do business with larger farming operations, because we do. But we also see the need for preserving the family unit out in rural America. And for us, that has always been our primary goal. And how do you do that as a lender? Well, number one, maybe you take some chances that some other traditional lenders won't take. Maybe because there's a little too much debt on the books, or because the farming operation maybe isn't of the best economic size to be involved in the financing of that operation. Or maybe there's just been some issues in the family business that you believe as a lender can overcome. But the bigger piece of this is helping agriculture see the technology that's coming. I'm a firm believer, and I'm not sure what side of the fence I'm on this, but AI, artificial intelligence, and the agricultural lending space is going to look a lot different 5 and 10 years from now. And I honestly think the delivery of agricultural credit to rural American family farms will benefit from that.
Speaking of ringing in a new year, Dr. Amy Hagerman is an Oklahoma State Extension Ag Policy Specialist.
Yeah, it's a great time to go back and revisit the paperwork. You know, I also feel like January 1st is a really great time to just, in general, revisit your risk management plan for your farm. Your insurance, making sure your coverage is good, making sure that it's covering the kind of equipment and the value of the equipment that you have in the barn now, right? Because that's a big deal. So just making sure that your insurance coverage looks good for the next year. It's a great time to do that as well. And then also thinking about what your risk management plan is going to be for the next year. How will these different programs fit into that? So thinking forward, what is my risk management for my operation going to look like? It's just a great way to start your new year.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
If they've got internal parasites, then their immune system is going to be diminished somewhat, right?
Texas A&M Livestock Specialist Dr. Tom Hairgrove.
In other words, if I'm not getting, even if my nutrition program is a pretty good program, but if those animals are real wormy, then they might not be getting, in other words, I'd be feeding them, but the parasites are doing some damage. So I'm not getting the maximum out of that good nutrition program. So again, I think timing is very, very important in deworming, and timing is very, very important as to when you want to try to assess, you know, how your program's going. So again, if it's a cow-calf operation, then I would certainly want to be looking usually in the spring. You know, usually in the spring is going to give you your best shot at kind of seeing how your wormer works. That's when those calves, especially if they're spring-born calves, they're going to be more likely to get some good data off those cats. Are going to be more likely to have parasites. Again, we can come back in the fall, you know, kind of after things have cooled down, and that's another good time to start measuring it, because again, at that time they're starting those larvae are coming back out of the stomach, and then they're going to be passed in feces again.
What about during drought?
As a rule, with the brown stomach worm, and that's kind of the one that we use as the bar, then if you have a very hot summer, right, and a fairly cool winter, they will be on the pasture. Dr. Craig has done some work on that, and most of it pretty close to Brazos County, but it would still be applicable pretty much anywhere in the state. Is what's happening is those pastures and measuring those larvae on the pastures, they were nearly nothing in the summer. It was just a flat line. Then in the fall, they come back up again. Okay, so in that period of time, that I think you're wasting your time to really try to get an idea is how effective is my wormer, what's my parasite loads, et cetera, because I can fool you, because a lot of those parasites are going to be, like I say, encysted, et cetera. They're not going to be picking a lot off the pasture again. Now, again, with homunculus, and that's turned out to be a big issue, and I've been at this for several years, and this is the first time since probably the early 80s that I actually have seen adult cattle or in calves dying of parasites. And we did see that in 21, and we saw it in two or three different places. And there was no doubt that that was the issue. I mean, we brought cattle down here and had them deep crop seed in the lab, et cetera. And the only issue we could find was parasite load. So again, that was a stressful year for one thing. We had a lot of cold in the winter and whatever. There was a lot of stresses going in, and all of those cattle were usually on a Bermuda grass pasture. And they had been dewormed, but there wasn't a follow-up, a check on that dewormer. Now, again, we blame dewormers, the product, a lot of times, right? But going back is what other issues could be contributing to this resistance. So I've got a lot, you know, how do I dose those cows? You know, I'm going to run 100 cows here this morning, right? I've got variation in that weight. So am I going to set for the average? And a lot of people do. Well, that means I'm overdosing half of them and underdosing half of them. So usually, using common sense, we kind of try to hit the heavier weight, right? And if you've got a few old cows that are really, really heavier, that I mean, just you could certainly treat those a little different. But as a rule, try to shoot for that heavy mark. That's one of the places we see a lot of resistance when we get history on the herd, because a lot of times they weren't using, just weren't using the proper dose.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
For most of the winter wheat crop,
the situation there has actually improved over the last couple of months.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey told us, yes, the crop, of course, is not actively doing anything to help itself right now, but the weather has been kind to it.
We have seen mild conditions, so no sustained cold weather creating any problems for the crop. And in addition to that, we've seen the drought coverage in the U.S. winter wheat production areas decreasing.
From 49% down to 30, also going into the new year.
We already know we've got the best winter wheat crop based on condition reports since 2019. Hopefully we can sustain that improvement with less drought and keep the bitter cold away.
And the current El Nino weather pattern usually helps in that regard. And so an optimistic Brad Rippey says,
we should have a decent crop heading into spring of 2024.
This is Gary Crawford, Washington.